Good morning. I'd like to bring this meeting of House Fisheries to order. It's February 28th, and present are Representative Johnson, Representative Feige, Representative Gaddis, Representative Grice Tompkins, and myself, Chair Seaton. I wanted to remind everybody about their cell phones at this time, and today we are going to be looking at resuming our discussions on Chinook bycatch and potential fisheries sponsorship of bycatch resolutions, as well as we're having two presentations, one by John Groover of United Catcher Boats, and the other will be Becca Robbins Gisclair, Policy Director for Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association. So, Mr. Groover, would you come forward? And welcome to the committee, and would you introduce yourself and who you represent for the record, and go ahead with your presentation. And I believe everyone should have that in their packet as well as on the screen.
Okay. Well, thank you, and good morning. I'm John Groover. I work with United Catcher Boats, and I'm the intercooperative manager. UCB has two members, basically two sides to it. We have a 65-boat membership that that United Catcher Boats directly represents, and then I also work with all 118 AFA-qualified catcher vessels and work with their issues that came about with the American Fisheries Act, restrictions in other fisheries and things like that. And so United Catcher Boats contracts to all those vessels. Some are members of the United Catcher Boats, some are not. Some are members of other associations, and some are independent vessels. So I'm here today, though, to talk about the Inshore Salmon Savings Incentive Plan, and this is Chinook Salmon Bycatch Management by the Bering Sea Inshore Fleet. So this is a fleet that of catcher vessels. The one is here in the photograph here, coming into the port in Dutch Harbor, you see on the first page. They're boats that have up to five or six crew members, sometimes as few as three or four. They catch pollock with midwater trawls, and they put them in refrigerated seawater fish holds in their vessels, and they deliver them to cooperative-based ports in Dutch Harbor, Accutan, to the Northern Victor Floater in a bay just south of Dutch Harbor, and in King Cove, Alaska. So, moving on. Okay. Which one is it? Here we go. So, just briefly wanted to talk about Amendment 91. I guess I really don't need my notes. So I think you got a briefing on this last week, but this was an amendment that spent 3 years in front of the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, went through an EIS process, and in the end, they put new regulations on Chinook salmon bycatch, and that was Amendment 91. And these started in 2011, these caps and restrictions. So it implemented a hard cap on Chinook salmon bycatch in the Bering Sea pollock fishery. Previously, there had been a set of triggered closure areas for Chinook salmon, and this replaced those. And there also had been a rolling hotspot program that the fleet managed. And I believe you heard about a rolling hotspot program and how that works last week. And you know, that Stephanie Mattson presented to you. In the CPs, the catcher processor sector has an incentive plan that they put together that uses a rolling hotspot component and has upgraded to the vessel level on bycatch. But I don't need to give her a presentation today. So anyway,
yes. Wanted to go back. So for the AFA vessels, has this then replaced the rolling hotspots for the catcher vessels?
Yes. So the in Amendment 91, previously we had Amendment 84, and that allowed us an exemption to these triggered closure areas that were in regulation, and that component, or Amendment 84, was for Chinook salmon and chum salmon rolling hotspot programs. So when Amendment 91 came along, it replaced the Chinook portion of that rolling hotspot exemption, or Amendment 84 for the fleet. So the fleet still operates under Amendment 84 for chum salmon rolling hotspot avoidance, but when this Amendment 91 came along, it allowed each sector or a group of vessels that could put together an IPA, and we can talk about that a little more, to manage, take management actions that were new or unique, and build an incentive plan. So that,
yes, that answered my question. And we have enough time so that if members want to ask a question as we go, we'll do that to make sure that we don't get our questions lost toward the end. So.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So there were three options under Amendment 91, but they definitely, these options steered the fleet to the IPA option, which was, there's a 60,000 fish hard cap for groups of vessels that put together an incentive plan agreement. Or if nobody had put together any incentive plan agreement at all, there would have been a 47,591 Chinook hard cap that would have been split amongst the sectors. Or if you had part of the fleet agree to participate in IPAs and other people that were hesitant, they would have raced for their historic Chinook allocation based on 28,496, and they would have been in an Olympic race for this hard cap, wouldn't have had a lot of much less salmon to work with. Clearly, the council was trying to steer away people from this option and really push them towards the incentive plan. And that's what happened. Every AFA vessel participates in an incentive plan agreement. And because the fish are split up amongst three sectors, the natural thing happened is that the incentive plan agreements all surrounded were encompassed by the sectors. So the catch and process sector has an incentive plan agreement, the mothership sector has an incentive plan agreement, and the inshore sector has an incentive plan agreement. And then CDQ participates in the catch and processor sector agreement because they don't actually fish; they have somebody else catch their fish. So there were allocations under options 1 and 2 to all four of these harvesting sectors in the Bering Sea pollock fishery. So to be qualify as an IPA, you had to provide incentives right now at the individual vessel level. So each vessel would be making decisions on how they were going to perform in regards to Chinook salmon bycatch. And you had to incentivize. These are all requirements in the council motion or Amendment 91. You had to incentivize vessels to avoid Chinook at all levels of abundance in all years. That was, of course, is the critical point here, is the idea of a traditional hard cap is that would be managed by the federal government would go up to a certain level, and that would be it. And here, and that could happen in any year, regardless of what the fishing conditions were. But here we had to explore areas and find areas that would keep bycatch below the hard cap level. And find ways to do that so that fish people wouldn't just fish up to the number, in other words, like a traditional hard cap. So, and we would have to reward vessels that successfully avoid Chinook or penalize vessels that fail to avoid Chinook. So these incentives.
Representative Feige?
Yes.
And I think maybe the briefing last week talked about this a little bit, but just practically, how do you manage to avoid salmon?
Sure. So we use a data company, C-State, that collects delivery data from fish tickets as they land. And they get it very, very quickly. And we also get reports from vessels that at sea, if they encounter a high number of Chinook or what is outside the ordinary, and to help us speed up that process. But we manage each vessel. We take at C-State. We have an active website that has, it tells each vessel what their latest landing was, records all their landings, what their bycatch is, and they can see how they're doing. And so they get immediate feedback so they know not where they just stand with themselves, but they also see where they stand with all the other inshore boats. And so they get that kind of data. But more importantly is they get the hotspot location data. So in other words, maps come out from C-State that are required to come out each week but come out as needed, you know, if there's other instances, and he locates on those charts of the Bering Sea where high bycatch incidents occur, and the fleet could move away. Is that,
basically you're just sampling, and you're trying to spread the sample information around the fleet as fast as you can.
Yes.
So that areas that essentially start popping up, but there's no, I mean, the fish are essentially the same size as the pollock.
There's a range of size.
Okay.
Yeah.
A rip and foggy. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm sorry.
So you can't just discriminate with a particular net size that excludes. There's no way to, like, scare away the Chinook with pingers or various things that sort of manually sort them before they even get to the net?
Not before they get to the net, but we do have a salmon excluder project that's been ongoing for the last 10 years. We're making quite a bit of progress. We've tried different designs that I'm very involved with that project. Mm-hmm. My background is as a fisherman and also work for gear companies. And we have an excluder that we've tested in the Bering Sea that under ideal conditions, testing conditions, we put a recapture net on top of the net itself, and then right before the caught end, where, if you've seen photographs, and I don't have any, but the pollock end up in what looks like a big sausage tube at the end of the net, and just ahead of that, while the fish are still swimming, the salmon are able to find what we create a lee, basically, in the net, a way to get out of the mass of pollock that are coming down through the net. Salmon have an ability, at least some do, seem to be able to do it, to swim up into this void, if you may, and it's kind of like a lee, like a rock in the river. There's nothing coming at them there as so much, and if they swim forward from that point, they can get out and escape. And we've had escapement rates as high over multiple tows as 40% with that device on Chinook salmon that we've tested. We can easily say that I believe the device gets 30 to 35% pretty steadily now, but it does depend on what you got to earlier, the size of the Chinook. It takes a stronger swimming Chinook to get out. So if it's a year of Chinook that are basically the size of a pollock, 1 to 2 pounds, they don't have that swimming ability. And so those fish end up in the cotton. But the larger year classes, if you get like an Ocean 3 fish, those guys are much better at finding this lee and getting out through the device. So it can vary from year to year based on the size of the bycatch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and proceed.
Okay, thank you. So the idea was that the incentives would influence fishing decisions, you know, in the wheelhouse at every level below the hard cap. And then there was this performance standard that was introduced, this new concept, and it was quite innovative, I thought. And it was, you know, to hold the bycatch to a level lower than the hard cap in most years. And so the incentive program had to show how it would do that. But most importantly, the incentive agreement had to describe right down to each vessel how they're going to manage their bycatch to keep their bycatch below the sector levels performance standard, not the hard cap. So you had to have rules that would show how these boats would accomplish that, and they had to do it, and they could not exceed the performance standard in any more than 3 years within a 7-year consecutive period. So that means that the third year would trigger this, and then the result would be that they would end up with a hard cap at the 47,000 fish level. So it really means that you get access beyond the 47,000 fish level in every 2 years out of 7, because the third would mean you'd violate this part of the program, because you can't let it happen the third year, basically.
And just to be clear, the performance standard is for the fleet as a whole. Incentive plan,
right,
agreement, not individual vessels.
No, because you have to run a program at the individual vessel level. In our case, in the inshore SIP, you do take the performance standard down to the individual vessel level. In fact, that's where the allocation is made. There's no allocations made higher than that. People, and we'll get to that. But it's that's exactly right. You allocate at that level, and actually you allocate at that level after you deduct 1,000 fish for an insurance pool to assure that if you do get somebody who just has an out-of-control situation and goes over, they can, you know, take fish out of the insurance pool, which is, has its own set of penalties too. And I won't confuse you guys with that today. It's a, that's way in the weeds, that stuff. So anyhow, so talk about specifically about our incentive plan. This is the presentation from last week that there we go.
We need a little.
If you just give
we'll
a break.
Take a brief. It is to.
I have
fill
it.
Up presentation.
So what I, you know, you had a presentation that you all saw from last week, but it was, we had to put that together rather quickly and didn't break it down to the catcher vessel sector. Instead, we looked at a higher level of how the SIP program worked at the 60,000 and 47,000 fish level. So what I wanted to do once I had some time to work on this is really get specific about the inshore sector all the way through, trying to be consistent. So that's what the change is here. So what that means is this allocation is split between these four sectors, and this is how it plays out. So the performance standard to all sectors, that 47,591 level, the inshore had 26,484 of that, motherships 3,707, the catcher process 13,516, and CDQ 3,883. And the same ratios were applied to that 60,000 fish hard cap, and the numbers are here as well, the 33,390 for inshore, 4,674 for motherships, 17,040 for CPs, and the 4,896 for catcher processors, or for CDQ, sorry. So, and keep in mind that hard cap, then, like we talked about earlier, is really only available in 3 out of 7 years. However, you have to explain in your IPA how you really only get there 2 times out of 7 years, because the third would basically be a violation and put you into the, not a violation, but you would have broken your agreement. So, anyhow. Just talk a little bit about the performance standard here, pointed that out again. And so anyway, get to the inshore sector. So I should say, so this program now that I'm going to give you is based on the inshore numbers of 26,484 and the 33,390. So inshore SIP, or Salmon Savings Incentive Plan. So the allocation, each inshore vessel receives its share based on its pro rata to its pollock allocation, a share of the 26,484 fish performance standard. However, we do deduct 1,000 fish insurance pool from them, so they actually get their share of 1,000 less than that. It held as a reserve, sort of a buffer. And they get an annual use limit of each, which is their, they cannot exceed in any year their share of the hard cap. So we don't let them transfer fish around, even though that's acceptable under the regulations, to go and catch their initial pollock allocation with a higher number of Chinook than what their initial share of the hard cap was.
Okay, and then again, Representative Chris Tompkins has a...
When you talk about a prorated share, is an equal share given to each catcher boat, or is it prorated on length or fishing capacity?
So originally under the AFA, the years 1995, 96, and 97 were the history years for AFA. So each vessel received a historic percentage of the pollock fishery, the inshore pollock fishery in this case, under the American Fisheries Act, that they in your best 2 out of 3 years of those 95, 96, and 97, and that was your vessel's pollock history. And so that essentially became when a vessel joins a cooperative and the cooperative is approved by NIMS, then the cooperative receives in total the history, the catch history percentage, the sum of the catch history percentages of that membership. And then that membership, through a private agreement, once that, you know, all these vessels come together and you get this number up here, and then they filter it back down to the individual vessel levels at the historic amount. So, and then part of Amendment 91, we actually got tables in regulation that tell us what each vessel's pollock history is. And so we made these allocations of Chinook salmon then based on a published pollock percentage for each of the vessels.
Thank
you. So there's a difference. The difference here is that the performance standard is an allocation, and the hard cap is an annual use limit. And so we'll talk about how can you get access to your share of the hard cap or your annual use limit. And so one thing again. So the vessel's not, they can't exceed their base cap then unless they earn salmon savings credits, and that's the incentive in SIP. So when a vessel catches less Chinook salmon than its allocation, its share of the performance standard, these savings credits is how they access that gap between the performance standard and the hard cap. And they earn one savings credit for every three salmon that they avoid below their share of the performance standard or their allocation. So you've got, in order to get one fish above the performance standard or your allocation, the savings credit, you've got to not catch three Chinook in a year. So that means that the hard cap is not a hard cap in the usual sense at all. And I know there's been a lot of interpretation that the hard cap limit is a hard cap in the Bering Sea, and that the pollock fishery can go out and catch 60,000 fish. And it absolutely is not that type of a hard cap. We used to see that in crab. We see it in halibut. And that's not the way this one works at all. So the only way you get to that 33,000 number is if you've earned enough salmon savings credits to get there. And as I mentioned earlier, you have to have avoided three Chinook previously for every one that you get towards that, and one you could catch towards that hard cap limit. And once again, under the terms of the agreement, you can only utilize those fish in every 2 years out of seven, across the fleet.
So are you talking about in the previous year avoided and we're below, or is that cumulative for years?
You get 5 years to accumulate credits, because it would be nearly impossible, but possible for a boat to do it in 1 year. You'd have to be extremely good. But we keep salmon savings credits alive for 5 years in an account, and then they expire first in, first out. And so it's really about what you do for me lately to make this all work. And 5 years could seem like a long time, and people will build up enough credits, but they can't. Once again, keep in mind that even if they built up more credits than they could have to get to the hard cap level, they can only use them in a year up to the hard cap level. And as they use them, of course, they're consumed, and it reduces their savings account by that. So you cannot. Keep in mind then that if you fish above the performance standard level, you don't earn any savings credits, so you can't continually do that year after year, because you in those years you don't earn any credits, and in fact you burn the ones that you had. So it's not possible to go above the performance standard level year after year after year. So that means that bycatch is guaranteed over a series of years to be at the performance standard or lower. So if a vessel selected, she said, I'm just not going to worry about building up savings credits. I'm just going to fish as if I had a hard cap, at the performance standard level, less the insurance pool, whatever their allocation is. They could do that, but nobody has approached it in that manner yet at all. Everybody is concerned about the big year in building savings credits. So and I'm not saying that they're successful every year in different situations, but it is in the wheelhouse. This is a big topic. They're always thinking about what the consequences are of bycatch. So so what that means is that the level at 26,484, the performance standard bycatch average, it's not theoretical, it's not experimental, it's an absolute fact. When we went in front of the council for the presentation of this program originally under Amendment 91, we had two economists review it, came back and said that, and backed us on this issue. And they said that is absolutely the way this program works. And in fact, if you're going to use the incentives to try and maximize your account, to hold your account at at the hard cap level. So you always have enough credits to get to what you consider your annual use limit, what is your annual use limit. The system actually works at 21,750 Chinook. Is the incentive level that a fleet would have to maintain, a vessel would have to maintain its bycatch at that level in order to continually have enough savings credits for that, you know, for that unknown year that could be looming out ahead. You can think of this savings credits account as an insurance pool, if you might. So the inshore program also includes a rolling hotspot program. One of the points made that when you have a series of low bycatch years, and Representative Seaton, you touched on this, I think, you know, about years of how long you can acquire savings credits and that sort of thing. We do limit them over the five-year period. But, you know, if you have a lot of really low bycatch years and it's easy to be a performer, you could really build up some savings credits. And so in these low times, then, there's a rolling hotspot component that during times of low Chinook abundance on the grounds, we have a rolling hotspot component that moves the fleet out of areas of high bycatch. And you can see this is an accumulation of where closures have occurred over the years. And we do also have in the program what is a Chinook conservation area. And in the area down to the lower right-hand side, which is right in what we call the horseshoe of the Pollock grounds, just north of Unimak Pass, there's a Chinook salmon savings area. And everybody, all the sectors, have a Chinook salmon savings component area, conservation area, closure component in their agreement. And this is a place that we know year after year after year, Chinook salmon bycatch is high. And so nobody fishes there. Yeah, that's it. There's no fishing. And I can tell you that the cost of that has been pretty high, because in the past, that's where the best row during the A season has come from. And the value lost to the pollock fishery by closing that grounds out permanently to the fleet has been very costly. And then that's it.
Great. Questions? I guess I had one.
Time, by the way.
What's that?
Thank you for the extra time.
Oh, yeah. And I had one question. How much of the fleet uses the bycatch excluder device that you were talking about of the inshore?
Yeah, there's a is that
didn't see it on the
yeah there's actually a separate presentation on the excluder that maybe that would be helpful, but I don't the
sure
let me let's see here. Yeah, you want to No, there isn't. That's fine. Yeah.
And we'll take a brief advantage while we're waiting to spool this.
So, yeah, to get to your question, Representative Seaton, the majority of inshore boats use excluders. Or own an excluder, and possibly everyone. We haven't surveyed them specifically about that, but there are different excluders out there. In other words, we have our research project has resulted in many different versions, and some boats have older versions, some boats have newer versions. Some co-ops require everybody to use an excluder all the time in the A season. You know, there are times in the B season where you just don't need one until around September, most people, I would say, are using them in the A season. It's very difficult for me to tell you everybody uses one 100% of the time, because, you know, if they rip up a net or they have an issue, that they may not be making a tow with an excluder.
But it is the most common practice in
the
industry. Okay.
So it's been a great project. We started about 12 years ago, and people had experimented with excluders in different locations, but we focused on the back end of a midwater trawl. So that's the upper drawing here, is basically the profile of a pelagic trawl. And people tried different size netting in the front. Of course, we use very large netting up there already. It's about, if you took the diamond and closed it, collapsed it, and measured it from one end to the other, the meshes in the front of the typical midwater trawl would be 30 meters long. They herd the fish together. And so they seems like they herd salmon as well as they herd pollock at times. And so the diameter then, if you think of this net as a large funnel and it comes back, and you get, as it progressively comes back, the meshes get smaller and smaller in size until you get a 4-inch mesh in the back end at the cod end and right in front of the cod end. So where we tried to work then was in front of the cod end. Before the fish get compacted back and they still have an ability to swim, seemed like a good starting point. And we've kind of we've worked over about a 30 to 40 foot, I mean, 30 times, 30 feet each section, about 120-foot range in the back of the net. We've tried different things, and we've run into all sorts of different issues at every point, and it's been a very interesting project. But the piece that the excluder that's worked the best to date is this excluder that's just right in front of the cod end, which is the bottom of the drawing. And basically what you see is this excluder panel, the red, drives the fish down and creates this lee above it, and the fish that have an ability to find that lee, in other words, get out, and we thought it would be kind of a water flow thing, but it turned out that really it's kind of a water flow thing, but it's more of a get out of the crowd, escape the masses, and a salmon can do that, or at least a Chinook salmon can do that. A chum salmon is a much more difficult time. And so this Chinook salmon that has a better swimming ability rises out of the crowd. They get this gap above them where they can sense that. And then they swim forward in this area above the crowd of fish that's coming down the net, and they swim up and they go out. And so the trick is to make sure that length or overlap there isn't so long that it isn't so short that a pollock could do it too. And because, you know, if you let too many pollock escape, at some point you're not. You just have to tow longer and catch more Chinook. It doesn't work. But right now, this excluder has had success up to right around the 40% rate, pretty steadily in the mid-30s, and with pollock escapement around 1% or less. So some details in drawing how that works, and you can see how this red panel drives it down. And I'll tell you, it took 3 or 4 years just to figure out how to put this panel in the net so that it didn't restrict the flow to the point that the pollock would build up in front of it and we just rip the net in total. We weren't very popular when that happened.
Representative Kreisel.
Does the use of an excluder affect the way a catcher boat fishes?
Sure, there's lots of ways that it could affect them and some ways that it couldn't, because the absolute best way to avoid Chinook bycatch is to fish where they ain't. Okay, but if you're going to fish, but if you're fishing in an area where there's some, or you know you're trying to reach a compromise, this works pretty good, and so. But the other side of the question is, does it affect the efficiency of the trawl? I think you're getting at, and so that's been, you know, our number one goal of all this is not to affect the catch rate to any noticeable degree, and we've certainly had captains, you know, that want to blame every tow that goes wrong on the excluder. You know, they're fishermen, and all the experiments that we've done, when people, you know, the guys that do the trials under our experiments, that we actually get a pollock quota to go fish, so people don't have to use their own fish to do this, and they get good buy-in into the program, and they all believe that this device retains the dynamic quality of the trawl. So we've got this big long funnel, and this trawl has to be able to expand as fish go down it. It has to be very flexible. If you put a rigid funnel in it, and this is one of the things we discovered and caused a lot of nets to tear out, you can't let that dynamic quality of the trawl's expansion and diamond netting, which is the key to that, opening and contracting, you can't take that away. And so this excluder, and that's where this flapper panel, this red panel's in there, took so long to develop, is we tried putting square mesh in there, which you think is, you know, runs, then you have twine that runs across the trawl and it can no longer expand then, and that was causing the tearing. So it took us a long time to figure out how to make diamond mesh position itself lower in the trawl, because the water wants to push it right back up. And the weighting and the placement of the weight, it took a long time to figure that out. And we believe now that this excluder, and then because of that, we know how to build excluders that don't affect the efficiency of the trawl at all. And our pollock, you know, one of those is, so it's not just the pollock loss of less than 1%, but it's also make sure the trawl catches pollock as well as it would normally. And we believe we've successfully addressed that finally.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we use a flume tank in Newfoundland to help. So we get basic designs, and then this is a tank, and we can put quarter to third scale and sometimes half scale models in here, not of the entire trawl, but just this section that we saw where the circle was in the net. And we use this tank at Memorial University in Newfoundland to test models and develop how to weight these panels and what to expect when things go down the trawl. We'll fill plastic bags full of water and drop them in front of this thing and run them through, and we get an idea of how this curtain, this is the excluder panel that we were talking about in here in green, how that gets affected by things coming down the trawl. And this has been, this tool, which there's basically three of these tanks in the world, and one's close enough in St. John's, Newfoundland, which isn't very close, but we go to this tank almost every year and retry our designs and test new designs. And this has been a very important part of this project. So the escapement we talked about in the winter, 2010 was the most recent test on this device at 40% for the Pacific Prince, which is a higher horsepower catcher vessel, delivers to Westward Seafoods in Dutch Harbor. And then we did a parallel test on the Starbound, which is a factory trawler in the catcher processors sector, and he was able to get 35% escapement. And that's done with a net that we had to develop that rides on top of the net. So we catch all the fish that come out of the excluder, and we don't get to count fish that may find their way back in after they've been excluded. So these are pretty solid numbers at this point. We've talked quite a bit about the design and the touchiness, so we don't need to spend any more time talking about that. And trying to stabilize this design over a wider horsepower range is one of our most recent projects. We're actually, our foundation that does this research is putting together a research project for Gulf of Alaska Chinook bycatch and the pollock trawl fisheries this coming in March at the end of their bee season. We're just yesterday started building devices for them. The foundation buys and puts them on those boats and develop recapture nets. We should be there in, I think, the last week of March, as soon as they finish their bee season. So you saw the most recent proven excluder, but we've moved on because we also want to learn how to exclude chums, and we thought maybe they should get out of the bottom. And our latest device and concept that's had some testing is this over and under device, and this lets fish escape out the bottom and out the top. It doesn't take up quite so much room in the middle of the trawl as the other one did. It looks like it even has on our video trials without a recapture net, we had less than 0.5% of pollock getting out of this device. We got a model out that we're trying to get video on, or a model, not a model, but a device on the Pacific Prince that they're just voluntarily using this A season while catching their own fish, and they're trying to get some video of it for us to help us figure out what's working with it. And so you get a little idea there that it's a little bit, it takes fish that could get out of the top and the bottom. We were trying to get rid of chum escapement. We never had better chum escapement than about 9%, 8% before. We moved up to around 20% chum escapement with this device. So we think we're on the right track. It has even less impact on the vessel, it looks like, more consistent results, are more consistent, holds its shape more consistently. So anyway, this project is ongoing and always has new developmental ideas, and we work with the fleet and other folks to do that.
Reverend Greg Tompkins.
How do you measure salmon escapement with these excluder devices?
So here, for this device that we tested last A season, we had 6 cameras on it. So this is one of the things that's resulted of this. Our excluder work has advanced underwater camera for trawl monitoring and net monitoring. We've advanced this science I'm not going to say we get all the credit for it because it's the National Marine Fisheries Service guys that do the development. But we, you know, it's been, this is one of been the biggest uses of cameras and most important, and so they've really developed a lot. So we actually were able to buy 6 cameras and have them made this year under a new design from them. And they're very compact, and we located those 6 cameras around this device last season, and we had hours and hours, hundreds of hours of video as a result. And then we paid people to monitor the video and count fish and count escapements. And that became very cumbersome. Prior to that, we built this net on top of the net, and it had to be very fine netting, and it rode on there, and it took us a couple years of development just to do that. And that was mainly done at that tank in Newfoundland. The basis for that work. Now we can design a recapture net, so we call that, without having to put it in the tank. We know the features and how to make it work. So that was a big part of this project, something totally useless to the fishery, but, you know, very critical to how we measured escapement. So we had absolute numbers. So those fish would end up in their own cod end, in other words, when they haul back, and they get to that cod end first, and they dump it, and then they compare it to the results of the what's in the main cod end of the boat.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Were there any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation. And Becca Robbins-Gisclair, are you online?
I am.
Yes, would you go ahead and identify yourself and who you represent for the record and proceed with your presentation? Or are we setting up a... You can go ahead and start while we're getting your, yes. Okay, we've got your presentation on the screen now.
Excellent. Good morning. My name is Becca Robbins-Gisclair. I'm representing the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association today. I also do some work for the Alaska Marine Conservation Council on this issue, and I'm sorry I can't be there with you in Juneau today. We're in the middle of a Board of Fisheries meeting here in Anchorage and couldn't get away, but Joe Klein, our executive director, is there in the audience as well. I know you've heard a lot about this issue already today and last week, so I'll kind of try to keep my background information a little bit brief and focus on some of our recommendations. So looking at slide 2, as you've heard, Chinook salmon bycatch is caught in the Bering Sea pollock fishery, as well as in the Gulf of Alaska in both the pollock and non-pollock fisheries. Moving to slide 3, this shows you kind of the different trends. In blue, you have the Gulf of Alaska Chinook salmon bycatch, and in red, the Bering Sea Chinook salmon bycatch. I'm going to talk briefly about both of these, first about the Gulf of Alaska, and then turning to the Bering Sea. And covering a little bit of what John just spoke with you about as well. So looking at slide 4 on the Gulf of Alaska Chinook salmon bycatch trends, you see on the left this just shows sort of the Chinook salmon bycatch in all of the groundfish fisheries, so that includes pollock and the other groundfish fisheries, which includes things mainly flatfish fisheries. And you can see there on the right sort of gives you the percentage of the bycatch in the Gulf, which is caught in the pollock fishery versus the groundfish fishery. And you can see that in general it's predominantly the pollock fishery in the Gulf that catches bycatch. But in looking at through the years, there are certainly some years where the other groundfish fisheries have even the majority of the Chinook salmon that's caught as bycatch in the Gulf of Alaska. And looking on the left at sort of the trends, you can see the recent spike in 2010, which sort of triggered a lot of concern as we're seeing in-river stocks declining while we have that really high bycatch. It was over 50,000 in 2010 in the Gulf of Alaska groundfish fisheries. Moving to the next slide, I know that you all have heard a little bit about the stock of origin information, and the bottom line is that in the Gulf of Alaska, we really don't have good information about where the salmon, which are caught as bycatch, are coming from. We kind of we have a sense of which stocks are there, but no idea sort of what and what the impact is on those and what level of is coming from each of those. But the, we know that the stocks present do include those from coastal southeastern Alaska, a grouping of stocks which is the sort of other group, but that includes the western Gulf of Alaska, which includes the Deshka, the Karluk, the Kasilof, the Kenai, the Nanilchik, and the Willow Rivers, and in addition, fish from the Pacific Northwest and British Columbia. In the pollock fishery in the Gulf, the with the new management measures that went in place in 2012, which I'll touch on a little bit later on, retention is required, and so we should be getting some slightly better information out of this fishery in the future. But for now, we just kind of have this general, we know what's there, but we don't know how much sort of information. Moving on to slide six, I know many of you in this committee are well aware of sort of the dire condition of many of the Gulf of Alaska Chinook salmon stocks right now. There are seven stocks of concern, six up in Upper Cook Inlet as well as the Karluk River. In 2012, the Setnet fishery was almost completely shut down and the Kenai River was closed to all recreational Chinook salmon fishing. And despite those restrictions, only four out of 12 escapement goals were met in Upper Cook Inlet. And, of course, there was also a disaster declaration for Upper Cook Inlet in 2012 with economic losses estimated at $27.7 million to commercial fisheries and direct and indirect losses to sport fisheries and, of course, additional losses to subsistence that we can't put a dollar value on. Moving to slide seven, the current state of management on the Gulf of Alaska, the pollock fishery has a hard cap of 25,000, and that went into place in August of 2012. The non-pollock fishery, which is the other groundfish fisheries, the council is currently in the process of considering hard caps for that fishery, and the range under consideration is 5,000 to 12,500. And that is currently tentatively scheduled for final action in June 2013. And kind of next steps that encompasses both of these fisheries is the Central Gulf of Alaska Trawl Catch Share Program, which the North Pacific Fishery Management Council is just beginning to look at sort of a more extensive program to address bycatch and may include some opportunities to reduce bycatch further as well as implement some of the more innovative things like John had covered that are being used in the Bering Sea that could be applied in the Gulf as well. In terms of Gulf of Alaska Chinook salmon bycatch, our current recommendations are for the pollock fishery that hard cap really should be reduced by at least half. The current cap far exceeds the 10-year average bycatch of 18,000.
Did we lose you? Okay, we lost the telephonic feed, so we'll be at ease for a few minutes while we reestablish that. Lost the connection and haven't been able to reestablish that. The committee has the presentation in the record, the rest of it. And so what we're going to do is go ahead and adjourn for today. And you have the presentation to look through. And we will try to reestablish as we consider Chinook in the future for the end of that presentation. But at that, does anyone have anything else to bring up for the committee? Seeing nothing, we will be adjourned at 10:07.